All right, we are, brethren, in the very middle now of the book of Ecclesiastes. We've come into chapter 7, got not quite, I guess, a third of the way through it last week. And in this part, that is just some of my favorite material in the book of Ecclesiastes. We went through a number of somewhat difficult passages, probably primarily because they're being some 3,000 years ago. We have some unfamiliarity with the culture and various expressions that they were using at the time. But when we've come to a section now that is just tremendously enlightening, I think, encouraging, even in the face of some sort of darker material, and certainly going to present some almost kind of provocative ideas that would seem rather strange to our ears. And so we're going to plunge back in again by picking up the last verse that we considered last week, which is verse 10 in chapter 7. Do not say, why is it that the former days were better than these? For it is not from wisdom that you ask about this. That is a passage which we spent significant time on last week. I just thought I'd pick up the thread there. How insightful that is, that we need to fight the natural human inclination, which they had 3,000 years ago, to think that the previous generation was better, and the one before that was better, and the one before that was better. Every generation has its problems. You're just trading one set of problems for another. Things may actually be significantly better, and we won't know it yet. In all these things, who's in charge? God is in charge. And whether the nation burns to the ground or becomes every bit as wealthy as Solomon's kingdom was, things are as they should be. There's God at home in heaven who's managing it all. And our responsibility is to learn the lessons that are presented to us, to be prepared to serve as we are called to do, in the culture and in the times that we find ourselves. So resist that urge, the natural thought that things are always better in the past. Who knows? The Beatles may be right. It's getting better all the time. They were thinking they have 60-something, in the 60s, late 60s. Yeah, maybe that's the case. We just haven't observed it yet. So then we come to two verses, 11 and 12, that I suggested you highlight in some manner as the good things that are in the book of Ecclesiastes, the things that we are told that are encouraging and uplifting and rewarding. 11 and 12, he tells us, wisdom, along with an inheritance, is good and an advantage to those who see the sun. For wisdom is protection, is the New American Standard translation. I think it's probably very correct and accurate. The literal expression maybe, again, is something that we couldn't relate to. It's just a difference in 3,000 years culture there. Literally, it says in verse 12, wisdom is in a shadow. Okay. In a shadow? What? But the idea there apparently is, if you have some big protector, you're like a little child next to the giant, who's on your side, where are you spending your time? In the shadow. And that's a good thing. Tonight it has to do with protection there. Somebody that is overshadowing you and watching over you. So in verse 12, wisdom is protection. It's a good way to translate it. Just as what is also protection? Money. Money is protection. Money does afford a level of security and helpfulness that can't be denied. Then in the latter half of verse 12, but the advantage of knowledge is that, and here knowledge and wisdom are being used interchangeably, is that wisdom preserves the lives of its possessors. Wisdom preserves the lives as opposed to the money. And they're both protectors. But if you've ever seen the inside of a doctor's office, true or not true, that no matter how much money you've got to throw at your physical problems, they may not be solvable, right? Okay? You don't get to control all of that very well. And so, yes, money is a protection, particularly for your stuff. If you have a lot of stuff, because you have a lot of money, you've probably got the best kinds of locks and, state-of-the-art security system, cameras, and all the rest of that, people to hire to be your guards, and, the finest security services or whatever, but they're both
a good thing. Get as much as you can of them, but recognize that in your pursuit of both wisdom / knowledge and money, which is the one that is going to protect the most of your life? It's the wisdom that you can be spending more time on, perhaps, because as we saw, particularly in the book of Proverbs, where again I suggested you have some scheme for identifying certain verses, and I forget the number now, but it was just one after the other, many, many passages that specifically said that wisdom is good for your, my favorite expression of all these was, your bones. Wisdom's good for your bones. And time and again, it's good for your health, it lengthens your days. There are a whole lot of different expressions, all of which went to being physically healthier and happier as a result of wisdom. So you may not be able to buy your health, but you can certainly learn how to make better decisions, devoting yourself to the Word of God, and then living that kind of a life that is in His shadow, the ultimate protector, will lengthen your days physically, as well as proving to be a protector for your stuff, you know, as well. You'll make the right decisions with it. Okay, now, verse 13 and 14 you might link together. Consider the work of God, for who is able to straighten what He has bent? In the day of prosperity, time for everything, be happy. But in the day of adversity, consider who made them both. God made them both. God has made the one as well as the other. God has made them both. It is one of the most difficult lessons for human beings to learn and to accept and then to roll with and to work with. We have a tendency to judge everything by what makes us comfortable, what makes us, you know, to be more at ease, what is freedom from adversity. And this passage is very specific. When the day of adversity comes, God has abandoned you? No! He made that day too. They are equally under God's control. Can you learn the same lessons from prosperity that you learned from adversity? Never. If you want to be a full and balanced and deep, wise, successful kind of a human being, then what do you need? You need a fair amount of adversity too. You need to learn how to handle those things that are problematic. I think this may be the principal reason why elders have to have believing children. Okay. If you have children, you've had adversity. You've had all kinds of opposition and worry, you know, and it will change your whole life. It gives you insight and understanding. It also gives you maybe discipline that you're just not going to get, you know, any other way. And so I'm being a little facetious there, but you see the point. You need both. God, in His wisdom, provides both. So when I bless one, prosperity, and curse adversity, what have I presumed to do? I am passing a judgment on whom and what? I'm passing judgment on God Himself and the way He chooses to work with me. Difficult lesson to learn and to accept and to work with and to profit from. As we're fervently praying, you know, if the days of adversity will go away, while God is probably saying, no, this is what you really need right now, you know, and be praying then that you learn the lessons that only they can provide. God has made the one as well as the other, so, the end of verse 14, that man may not discover anything after him. Save the best for last, there, didn't I? So first we're told that the adversity is every bit as valuable as the prosperity, and then what's the kind of kicker there at the end of verse 14? Are you ever going to understand it? No! Now, if you've learned anything from being at somebody's sick bed, If you've learned anything from having friends whose children were going off the rails, or whose marriage was, or who just lost a job and they're desperately, you know, in need of financial assistance and that sort of thing, when all those kinds of things are going on, what is the one thing that people ask for and pray for more than anything else? Why me? Understanding of why is this happening to me? And what does the passage say? God made prosperity, God made adversity, and what did he guarantee? He's not going to figure it out either. Okay? So when we're passing that judgment on the better, you know, days or the old days, and we're passing that judgment on prosperity is better for me than adversity, and we're learning that that's not necessarily so in either case, the punchline in verses 13 and 14 is that it is also not necessarily in our best interest to understand why these things are taking place the way they are. Somebody define for me faith. What is faith? Is faith understanding everything? Is faith being able to handle everything? Is faith not having anything to handle? You know, easy street, mold, cherries, and gravy. Okay? No. No. What is faith? Faith is that confidence, that trust, that belief that there is a God in heaven and that he will take care of me precisely because I what? I don't know what's going on and I'm powerless to do anything to change it. Faith only exists in the absence of both control and sometimes understanding. And so faith is when finally we are trusting to God instead of self. Long as whatever's going on in my life is something that I can handle, where's my faith? There's any faith. I'm self-sufficient, taking care of business, it's working real well, you know, and so great. What do I need God for? But when God sends the adversity, I don't know why, and he won't tell me, but it might be in my best interest. What is God growing in me? Faith. And without faith, it is impossible to please him. We've touched on this 100 times, I guess, and again, thanks to the Proverbs class, but it seems to me that of all the people on earth who have the greatest difficulty with faith, it'd be us. Why? Because we are living on easy street. And life is a voluntary grade by and large. And if we have an earthquake in the United States, then what happens? In about 30 minutes, there'll be heavy equipment picking the freeway up off of you. But when they have an earthquake in Nepal, it may be 30 days before they even get to your village to find out who survived. Okay? So, what a difference. We have so many advantages, an enormous wealth, you know, and all of this protection, and we just expect that if somebody doesn't help me, then the government has failed. Okay? Well, yeah, it has. And how much better living here where we got this government that is so dedicated to giving us every kind of service, you know, you can imagine when most of the rest of the world has government falsely so-called, you know, that is corrupt to the core, totally ineffective, and hardly there for you ever when you really need it. So, gonna figure it out? No. Learn to appreciate both prosperity and adversity? Yes. And are these days better than the old days? Tricked you there, didn't I? Just might be. It just might be. Okay. Verse 15. I've seen everything during my lifetime of futility. There is a righteous man who perishes in his righteousness, and there's a wicked man who prolongs his life in his wickedness. Do not be excessively righteous, and do not be overly wise. Why should you ruin yourself? do not be excessively wicked, and do not be a fool. Why should you die before your time? It is good that you grasp one thing and also not let go of the other. For the one who fears God comes forth with both of them. This is one of my all-time favorites.
This is the book of Ecclesiastes. It's the one particularly I had in mind when I said kind of a provocative and counterintuitive sort of thing. Okay? How much righteousness is too much? I've been worried about Diana over here for a long time. She's entirely too righteous. Okay.
Can I pick one here? And here's Ralph in the front row. Reads his Bible more than anybody else. The congregation, I'm sure, gets through it, I don't know, a dozen times a year and everything. And Ralph, I want you to back off on this wisdom thing. Because you're just running a good thing into the ground. And you're going to ruin yourself and die before your time. And you read a verse like that, and at first it just sends you cuckoo. What in the world is that about? Now, it may not be all that hard, though.
Name for me the people in the New Testament who were overly righteous. Okay, had his hand up before he even got a question mark. Who are just the ultimate in overly righteous, aren't they? Missing the whole point. But did Jesus in Matthew 23...
Let's go there and look at that passage. I'm going to come over to Matthew chapter 23. It's one of those passages that most everybody's very familiar with it. You know, we understand, the point that's being made right here. And so it's a very famous passage. You know, you probably almost could quote it. But let's come over here and just take a real close look and see if it won't help us with Ecclesiastes. You might want to even put Ecclesiastes next to this. Matthew 23:23, it's so easy to remember. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you tithe mint and dill and cumin. Now stop. Was that wrong? Well, no. Was it unrighteous? Well, no. Was he asking them to stop? Well, no. They were getting that part perfectly well. Then it says, though, and you have neglected the weightier provisions of the law. There are degrees of importance and value. Some provisions are weightier than other provisions. As a matter of fact, we saw last Sunday Jesus saying, he who delivered me to you has the greater what? The greater sin. There are degrees of sin. There are degrees of righteousness. And so here we have these scribes and Pharisees. They're doing the tithing thing just perfectly well, but they are neglecting the weightier provisions of the law, some of which are named justice and mercy and faithfulness. But these are the things you should have done. And then what does he say? Without neglecting the others. They were doing perfectly well with all their tithing. Now, not among the Lord's people, never from you, not in churches of Christ, I've never heard this, but time and again, denominational people will throw this verse at me, in the context of baptism or some other topic, and they say, that's your problem, Larry. You're just nitpicking and being like those Pharisees and so intent on trying to do things exactly right. And here Jesus is telling them, all that fighting and this and doing everything, that was unnecessary. Is that what Jesus said? No! He commended them for that. And then what, though? They neglected the weightier provisions. Now, let's talk about those commodities that they were tithing, though. Okay? Mint and dill and cumin. And they were kind of famous for this. Now, can you imagine somebody sitting down to, one of these mixtures of spices you put on your potatoes or something, and you got rosemary in there, and you got a little bit of garlic, and, maybe, I don't know, parsley and thyme, probably. Parsley root. Okay. Can you imagine somebody sitting down with their little razor blade and counting
one, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine seeds for me, one for God. What would that be? It's just overly righteous. Okay? God is really not expecting that you count every grain of salt. He does want the 10%, that is under the old law, of course, but when he was asking that of them, he wasn't asking them to count every seed. And if a man, had a barley harvest, did he have to count every grain? No. No, you can satisfy that requirement. So here Jesus was trying to help them to understand, keep it up, you're doing a fine job over there, go that route if you want, even that's ridiculously specific, if you want, but remember these other things too. Exactly right. And also something, by the way, I've been working with on these adjuncts. It does not matter how perfectly they kept the law or how perfectly moral I am if I don't have faith. And it won't matter how much faith I have, if I'm immoral. Okay? Works both ways. But when you make those statements, should you then say one is more important than the other and so I should emphasize this and sort of neglect that? No, because they're all equally important, aren't they?
And that's a problem people often have. You say, well, I know there's weightier provisions of the law. I'm going to really focus on them now and ignore or neglect the lesser provisions of the law. Is that what he was teaching?
No.
Okay? Now, still, difficult verse. Go back again to 16. Do not be now excessively righteous and do not be overly wise. And apparently in both cases, if you overdo the righteousness thing and you overdo the wisdom thing, what happens to you?
You ruin yourself. Okay? So God is intending that we can know and obey His expectations for us. But we can also get swept away and caught up in it. And most often, if you're overly righteous or overly wise, what is the natural mental attitude that's going to go with that? With the Pharisees again. Yes. The arrogance and conceit. Yes. But, they said cowering egos.
When we're counting every step that we take and counting every action that we do, we're taking the joy out of our life. Is that right?
Well, exactly. And you would, put a burden on yourself that's unnecessary and debilitating. Now, in 17, the converse, do not be excessively wicked and do not be a fool. What happens then? You're going to get yourself killed. You're going to die before your time. Be excessively wicked and be excessively foolish. See, typically die before their time. But what did he just said in verse 15? What had he just said? I've seen everything during my lifetime of futility. There's a righteous man who perishes in his righteousness. There's a wicked man who prolongs his life in his wickedness. Now he's telling us don't be overly one and don't be overly the other. And you come down to this verse 18. It's good that you grasp one and also not let go of the other. For the one who fears God comes forth with both. Now, putting 17 and 18 together, does that allow, endorse, condone, or encourage sin of any kind? No, it does not. But it also recognizes, brethren, that there's going to be a certain amount of what in your life? It's going to be a certain amount of sin in your life. You fail. There will be a certain amount of righteousness in your life. There will be a certain amount of wisdom. Who among us is only wise, never foolish? How many times in a day do you go, no? Is that the way Homer used to do it? No. He said, how dumb was that? Sure wish I had, what in the world, was I thinking?
But I think what he's trying to say, brethren, and I very much would like to get some feedback on the class and from the class, and maybe even some examples of overly righteous and overly wicked and overly wise and overly foolish. God is trying, through Solomon, to promote wisdom. He's trying to promote righteousness. He's trying to get us to limit as much as humanly possible foolishness and wickedness. And at the same time, he's saying grasp both, don't let go of them, and, you know, you're going to have a balance that is necessary. Now, my take on it is, from 1 John and chapter 1 and other places as well in 1 John, if you say you have no sin, then what? You're a liar and the truth is not in you. Okay? You just better accept that. And it's terrible and it's awful and it's embarrassing and you're sorry and you try to do better, you know, the next time, but it happens. Okay? And if you say it doesn't, you're a liar. And the truth is not in you. Okay? So in that sense, I think he's saying, you grasp it, not in the sense that you say, well, it's okay, God gives me a certain allowance, you know, I got permission here. Use not your freedom as what? License. Okay? Now, Mike.
I'm glad you brought that verse up, because that makes a little bit more sense when it says...
Lift your head there. I can't hear you, Mike.
I'm glad you brought that verse up, because when it says do not be overly wicked, I mean, that's why it's saying that you're kind of wicked. I mean, that's what they're saying. Don't be too wicked, but when you say it with that verse, it makes a lot more sense.
Yeah, that's exactly it. It's still saying limit it as much as you can, okay? But you don't throw yourself off a cliff when you foul up, Dean.
So I think that's the key. You know, if we are overly righteous, we are either going to A, assume we don't do anything wrong, or B, destroy ourselves when we do something wrong. So as a preacher, how many times have you had a Bible study with somebody and they say, when I get this part of my life together, I'll come back to church? And you're just like, what? But then you take the wicked side of it that has no care for their eternal soul. So they put no time, no effort into walking that straight and narrow path. This, to me, is just saying you need to see yourself for what you are. You're a human being. You need to strive every day to please God because that's what matters. But it's not over when you make a mistake. You're going to fall. You're going to come short here, there, or somewhere. And you need to accept that and then move forward accordingly. We understand how we move forward from that. We repent. You know, we share our problems with others. We do whatever it is that we have to move forward. We don't just sit in a hole and kick ourselves and bang our head against the wall and go, you sinner, it doesn't work. But it's just a common sense approach to life.
Amen. And I'm so glad it's there, aren't you? Kind of the same way we're also glad that Peter's in the Bible, right? He who had that terrible foot and mouth disease we keep talking about, you know. It's his example of constantly messing up. It gives us a little bit of hope. Carol?
Getting this right, it says if you grasp the one thing, which is your sinfulness, that's like the alcoholic or the gambler or any sin that you have that's an over, you grasp the fact, I am a sinner.
Okay.
You still own it. You have to own it. But then you cannot let go of the other, which is the righteousness of God, which is going to save you, and it says not to fear God, that comes wisdom. So the wisdom comes from knowing that God's righteousness is the one that will continue to help you from where you were.
Exactly. We're counting from the New Testament not to think too highly of yourself. Jesus commanded that we judge with what? Righteous judgment, using his standards, his definitions. Now, all these things go to the same thing, but it's just such a wonderful way that Solomon put it because it's so provocative. You know, it sounds like he's saying, make sure you have a little bit of wickedness in your life. That's okay.
And you want to have a certain percentage of foolishness in your life too. And it's really not. He's saying there will be, and as Dean pointed out, and you need to not only accept that and understand that, but you also need to do battle with that, which is Carol and Dean both are saying, you know, you get up and you make war against those things that are evil.
Okay, any other comment or question? And I would link together 16, 17, and 18, not in the color of, you know, an advantage or a reward, something that's encouraging under the sun, but the title is three together because they really need to be, you know, worked together. And then we get another one of these upbeat, here's a reward in life verses. So if you're marking them, you know, in that scheme, it's verse 19. Wisdom strengthens a wise man more than 10 rulers who are in a city.
Now, apparently, the idea is, if you have a city and you've got 10 rulers, then two things are probably so. One of them is, it's a very successful city. Probably very prosperous, a lot of, you know, mercantile, you know, activities going on. You know, they needed a lot of this oversight. But you know, I think there's an assumption there, too, that if you have 10 rulers, you've got 10 wise, powerful, effective, helpful people that can protect you, your town, answer your problems, and get you through life. So it'd be really a good thing, Solomon is saying. If you lived in such a town, boy, that'd be great. You know, 10 rulers in the town, how could you go wrong? All right, but wisdom strengthens a man more than that. Your own personal wisdom will keep you out of those problems that would send you scurrying for the answers of the 10 wise rulers anyway, wouldn't it? See? Acquire that wisdom for yourself, and you won't need those 10 men. You will become one of those men, and or women, of course. So, one of those you want to highlight, get after that wisdom there. And in the light of what we've just been talking about, you know, that's not to say that there's any good thing in foolishness. You have to accept sometimes to do that, to pursue that wisdom. That's quite a protection for you and your possessions, your life. Now, 20. Indeed, this goes directly again to what we have been saying, there's not a righteous man on earth who does good and who never sins. They do not exist. Now, do you know what the word Pharisee means?
I'm going to have to make sure with Jared, but I think the word Pharisee means separated, doesn't it? Isn't that the root word? Yeah, I thought it was.
Pharisee means separated. They had named themselves as the separated ones. And what do they mean by that separation? I am pure, holy, righteous. You are something to be shunned and kept away from. Because if I get too close to you, what happens to me? You make me dirty. See, you're a detriment to my perfection.
I love me.
that's exactly it. And to the exclusion of everybody else. So now, coupling that, especially with what Dean said, Cheryl, a little while ago, you know, but verse 20 kind of casts all that off. There's no such thing as a righteous man on the earth who only does good and who never sins. Accept it.
Yes.
Amen. why shoot yourself in the foot? So now, 21 and 22 would go together. Also, he says, do not take seriously all words which are spoken, lest you hear your servant cursing you. For you also have realized that you likewise have many times cursed others. Okay? Now, if somebody's gossiping about you, if somebody's slandering you, if somebody's, you know, working against you in any way, you know, how does that feel? Well, you know, it's awful.
And you hear some rumor, you know, whatever's going on, and somebody said they heard thus and such, you know, and put in an email, or you find it posted on Facebook, or whatever else it is. Drives me crazy, brethren. If you go online, don't do this. If you go online and you Google, who hasn't, though, Larry Haverstock. Okay. We all want to know if we got a footprint on the net, you know. You go and you Google Larry Haverstock.
in the first couple of lines is stuff I'm pretty proud of. You know, photographs that I've posted from Israel and, you know, number of things like that. But for the last probably 15 years, I think it's the third listing right up there at the top where nobody can miss it. It's some guy who's all over my case because he thinks I don't understand marriage, divorce, and remarriage, and he's just tearing me apart. Okay? Now, is that really what I want the world to see? You know, not that anybody but me Google Flurry Aberstein, you know. But, you know, every once in a while, somebody tries to find me from high school. You know, that's not what I want them, you know, to find. Now, what should I do about it? How should I feel about it? What did you say about it? Yeah. So what? Don't take it seriously. You've done the same thing to other people and any righteous person anywhere. So, you know, if you listen around like that, you're going to hear your servant cursing you. Now, how many people, lords and masters, would think that a servant knew what they were talking about if they criticized you? What do they know? What have they ever done? They're totally dependent upon me. They can't understand the decisions I make. Who do they think they are? You know, to criticize me, I'm writing the checks. Okay? Yeah, that's right. So, you know, if you hear it at all, shrug it off and forget it. Man, best you not listen. Okay? 23. I tested all this with wisdom, and I said, I will be wise. But it was far from me. What has been is remote and exceedingly mysterious. Who can discover it? I directed my mind to know, to investigate, and to seek wisdom and an explanation, and to know the evil of folly and the foolishness of madness. And I discovered, more bitter than death, the woman whose heart is snares and nets, whose hands are chains. One who is pleasing to God will escape from her, but the sinner will be captured by her. Behold, I have discovered this, says the preacher, adding one thing to another to find an explanation, which I am still seeking but have not found. I have found one man among a thousand, but I have not found a woman among all these. Behold, I have found only this, that God made men upright, but they have sought out many devices. Now, Song of Solomon notwithstanding,
how does Solomon sound here? You know, I'm really trying to figure it out. Remember, each time he says, with my wisdom and my intellect, you know, I said I'm about to do this, he has been great, both personally and then by God, miraculously, with intellectual powers and experience that nobody before or since has ever had.
So when he says he set about to do it, if it could be done, he'd have done it. So he said, I set out, and all this goes together. I tested wisdom. I'll be wise. Couldn't do it in 23. 24, the remote, the exceedingly mysterious. It's going to stay that way. I couldn't figure it out. I directed in 25 my mind to know, investigate, seek wisdom, and an explanation. Plus, I wanted to know about folly and madness. I discovered, and it seems like he shifts gears right here. And it's probably the least favorite passage for any woman, you know, ever written.
My apologies. It's just one of the most awful things in Scripture. This is sure not Proverbs 31, is it? You know.
And what about the Psalm of Solomon? He praises it.
He did. He did. See, and these are the kinds of things that the scholars then go and they spend endless hours trying to determine, when did he write the Song of Solomon? When did he write this book? You know, is it at the end of his life, in the middle of his life? Did he meet the girl, you know, after he wrote this passage? And so finally he found one, you know, hey. You know, and I can't answer any of those questions. I don't know when he wrote these things. But look, we've just been through a whole lengthy passage. Which one should you have exclusively? Righteousness or wickedness? Well, you can't exclusively, you know, have either, so you can't. And so So here we get another one of those contrasts where he sings the praises and glory of the woman he truly loved, and now says, I can't even find one, you know, anywhere. So I don't know where he was at these times in his life, but they were both true at some point. Jerry.
This expression regarding man, that one in a thousand, which speaks of the rarity of the kind of man that he is talking about, a good man. Is there a connection between the woman that he mentions here and the woman he has described previously, the woman whose heart is snared and net? What is to be found among womankind of that sort? Is there a relationship between these two verses?
Well, you'll have to tell us what it is. I'm drawing a blank.
Well, I'm just saying that that this is not a wholesale deprecation of women, but of, in this context, the kind of woman that he has introduced previously in it. That kind of woman, how many are you going to find that you would put your trust in or take home to meet your mother?
They're rare. Okay, you were going to add to that, Michael.
No, I'm just saying a woman has a heart that's married and trapped or whatever you think. A woman that does have this marriage and trapped, the way I think of it, I didn't think you saying that it's woman herself.
Not womankind in general, you're saying, but limiting himself to that discussion. Okay, you know, of that evil woman, and it's more bitter than this.
Proverbs 31 woman, that's great, but there's also the woman with the trap and snares in her heart.
To be feared and avoided, and becomes another one of these expressions of why wisdom is so much better than foolishness. See, okay, that's what he's driving at. Okay, so, ultimately though, in the passage, okay, wisdom or folly? Which one are you going to really look for? Wisdom. Righteousness or wickedness? What are you really pursuing? Okay. Now, righteousness and wisdom will protect you. Wisdom has the advantage of also protecting your life. Okay? Overdo it. Probably run away with arrogance and conceit, and you're harming yourself. Don't overdo it. But recognize that if you accept who you really are, shades of Dean yet again, and you can accept that and yet continue to drive forward to do the best that you possibly can, that wisdom will protect you. It'll protect you in all circumstances. It'll protect the man from the evil woman more bitter than death, whose heart is snares and nets and whose hands are chains. Because, and this is where you want to get to the end of it in verse 29, behold, I have found only this. So however rare these righteous and wise men or women are, God made men what?
Upright.
But they have sought out many devices.
Brethren, that is just a critically important thing to remember. Often you'll see this debate, you know, on the internet even, you know, it was going around here 5-6 years ago, there was a big deal going on, or people inherently evil or inherently good. And there for a while, a whole lot is up in the air among the saints as well. For some reason this took off, and I remember seeing everybody firing emails all around, you know, on Facebook, and trying to decide if we're inherently good or evil. Now, of course, among the Lord's people, we're not suggesting that original sin is true. You know, nobody believes that. But it was just about the nature, the character of man. Okay, if I was to get involved in such a discussion, this verse would play a prominent role. Okay, and then my argument would be, how are we made? We are made in the image of God. In Him there is no darkness at all. And if we're made in His image, is it physical or spiritual that we're made in that image? It's not physical. He has no flesh. So, spiritually, the spirit that is within us that animates us and gives us cognizance, that spirit comes directly from whom?
God.
from an all-righteous and pure God. He made us upright. Well, what did he also give us? Free will. And so what do we do? End of verse 29. You seek out many devices.
Somehow we just get, off the track. And so God gives us a good and healthy push, but we seek out these many devices. And now that applies to everybody. We stumble, we fall. Deep.
Well, I think that last verse, and then if you go all the way back up to the 20th verse, it sums up the woman issue without offending women.
Okay, please.
In the fact that if I am overly righteous, I look up here at verse 20, it says, there is not a just man on the earth that does good and does not sin. So quit thinking that you're one. If I think that I'm one, I'm a Pharisee, or if I'm Solomon, how many wives does Solomon have? Why did he pick those women? If you have 700 wives, or you have all these, what are you looking for? You're looking for beautiful women, and they catch your eye. But this righteous man here that recognizes that I sin, that I need help, that I need God, as I travel, if my focus is this beautiful creature out there, and not searching out someone who is going to help me grow spiritually, then I'm going to very easily be distracted from my goal.
And destroyed.
And I think that's the warning. I think that's why we can look at the Song of Solomon, and he met this woman that he just truly loves. He's got all these wives, but he's got this woman that he truly loves. But as men, we all know how easily our wife can redirect us, most of the time for good, at least in my case. Focus, direct, put on the right path. But if we have a wife that wants to steer us the other direction, they have great pull.
Okay, now, that was the very element I wanted to put in next. What is the only fault that God ever attributes to Solomon? What was his one sin?
Too many wives.
Was not too many wives. What was it? He took wives from the foreign countries. And then, what did he allow them to do? What were they after him all the time? See?
And that's what I think I'm seeing here at the end, too, is those women you were just mentioning who were exerting that influence to lead him astray, and they succeeded. His one great and tragic failure, and apparently the last one at the end of his life, it's the last thing we find out about Solomon. There isn't any more about him. It's what we're told is a sort of a summary of his life, is that that's where he failed, because of those women leading him astray, profoundly powerful for either good or ill. Okay, any other comment or question? Let's go ahead and take a few more verses, as it's not necessary to keep it all in context here, and we'll keep moving. I've got only 5 minutes, but let's use them. And so go to Ecclesiastes 8 and verse 1, and use your marker for whatever is one of these rewarded passages. Who is like the wise man, and who knows the interpretation of a matter? A man's wisdom illumines him, and causes his stern face to beam. Change literally, but to beam is the idea. Okay? So what is he now saying is just the inherent nature of wisdom. It will make you happy. Now, he told us earlier that in much learning, there is also much sorrow or grief, depending on your translation, sorrow or grief. So, that's true, but that's the point of this book. And a lot of people are missing this. They're saying, it's so negative, it's so down and all of this. And it's not that. Solomon's saying, those are elements in your life that you can never escape. And here's the balance. Now learn how to accept both. You grab the one, but don't let go of the other. And if you can get on top of all of this, then all that negative, down stuff, you've got a counterbalance for. And ultimately, with much learning, there's also much grief. There's pain. It's difficult to do. You have to force yourself to do it. No pain, no gain is as true mentally as it ever was physically. So it's true. But he's not saying, I want to discourage you from pursuing it. He's trying to encourage us to pursue it. Because Because, in this verse, just yet another of them, in verse 1, what will wisdom do for you? Make you happy. It'll make you happy. Brothers, if you really get it, that adversity is from the hand of God, and it is good for you, and it would be a mistake, it would be foolish to say, now that you've got it, the former days were better. If you get that, then in the midst of that adversity, what will you be able to do that a whole lot of other people really can't? Be happy. It's okay. I understand, Lord. There's a time for everything, and now I'm in this time. And I accept that. Paul said, I have learned to be content. And then he started giving us some examples. And what was the point? It didn't matter if he had a Tempur-Pedic bed or he was sleeping in a rain on a rock. He had learned what? How to be content. See? So wisdom is a great thing. With the air comfort one, I always thought I'd like to have one of those where you just push the air on your bed and make sure you're married. Whether you got a bed like that, you'll be happy. It's great. Kicks in, things go wrong, you lose it. You spring a leak in your water bed, you get a punched hole in your head, or whatever it is, and now tonight you're sleeping on the board. What are you supposed to do? Don't worry. Be happy. And wisdom helps you to do that. That's what it's all about.
Okay, well, we'll stop there because now we're going to get into all this command of the kings and everything. Any last comment or question?